Zuma Radio, the original greatest hits, great Toronto group, Robbie Robertson and the band, and the Beach Boys started the hour. This is the Morning Zoom with Sam and Jane. Happy to welcome a very special guest. We have tried to get John Tory on the Morning Zoom a bunch of times, but he is a mayor in demand, navigating millions of people through a pandemic. And we're okay with that. We have him now. That's all that matters. Toronto Mayor John Tory, welcome to the Morning Zoom.
Yeah, good morning to you both. Pleasure to be here.
Mayor Tory, on a personal note, as a Toronto taxpaying resident and a Toronto newscaster, I want to thank you for your steadfast guidance and reassurance all the way through the pandemic. This effort really cannot be underestimated. It has meant a lot. It really has.
Well, I appreciate that. The reassurance is something I really have focused on because I think, you know, what's been almost as bad as the actual illness and the tragedy that has, affected many families is the worst, obviously. But I think after that, it's the anxiety that's been out there. And so I've tried by, being in the media and being available to answer questions all the time. And sometimes it's the same questions over and over again, but it doesn't matter because if you can reassure people and comfort them that, we have a plan, that we're doing our best, although there's a lot of unknowns associated with this whole pandemic, then I think that helps people just to sort of stay calm themselves in their own lives. And frankly, it keeps me calm too, just to sort of, focus on what we are doing and what our plan is and be able to tell people about that. So it's just been, it's part of my job, and it's something that I have considered very important to keep doing.
Mr. Mayor, how has the pandemic permanently changed Toronto for the better? And then part two of the question is, what about inefficiencies and how has the pandemic magnified those? So first, how are we changed for the better permanently?
Well, I think we're changed for the better just in terms of people seeing that they could make a difference in their own community. I think more so than ever. Torontonians were good about getting involved in supporting and helping others. But I think when it's come to the food security programs and looking in on seniors and making sure they're okay and all the different things that people have done as individuals in their own neighborhoods, I think it has kind of highlighted the importance of that, and it's hopefully left an impression on people that this is not just something you should do during a pandemic. I think on the flip side of it, it really has heightened our awareness of the disparity that exists between different parts of the city. Just in the last couple of days, we've been looking at the maps, for example, of how many children have been vaccinated, 5 to 11 years of age. Mm-hmm. And if you look at, the center part of the city, Lawrence Park, Moore Park, the Annex and these places, it's 80%. If you look at, Rexdale or over in some parts of northeastern Toronto and Scarborough and Malvern, it's 25%.
Yeah, that really provides evidence of, as you say, what we already know about people who have and people who do not have, and also speaks to, for those of us who are privileged, it's very easy to get a booster shot, to take time off from work, to have our employers say, sure, take a few hours. But for those people, and the sick day issue became really big during the pandemic, they're not able to take time off work without losing pay.
No, that's right. And it's one of the reasons we had to adjust some of what we did in the context of, for example, making, and we're doing it to this day, vaccinations very, very local. So we're literally doing individual buildings now and having people go and knock on doors, which is a different approach than when we started with the sort of mass vaccination clinics and it was kind of a build it and they will come. And things like sick days, in our case, we fought hard to get the sick days, which ultimately came about to one extent or another. But we also had to adjust the hours of our clinics, for example, as well, just to say, well, look, a clinic that finished at 7 o'clock at night wasn't necessarily going to be that helpful to someone who's getting off shift, at some time other than that. So we've tried to do a lot of that, but a lot of it's just been by local accessibility of these clinics and by having ambassadors. We have hundreds of them literally going door to door.
Let's talk about housing. There are many layers to housing. Folks who live on the street, shelters that are dealing with COVID outbreaks, and the fact that a whole generation of Torontonians will probably end up leaving if they want to buy a home. Housing in Toronto, Mayor Tory, what's the future?
Well, it's the biggest issue of all. It would take us hours. But as you say, because there's so many layers. But if I can deal with two parts, one is affordable housing. I sometimes call it workforce housing because people mistake what that is. Affordable housing, workforce housing, is for the first-year nurse, the first-year teacher. And while they make a good living and have probably a secure job with a good future, if you make pick a number, $50,000 in your first year, it is difficult if you're on your own and to find a place to live in the city that's affordable. And so we're looking to dramatically expand the supply of that, and we're well underway with programs that are producing thousands of units, and we're able to keep them affordable thanks to support from the federal government principally, and also that we're using public land, for example, so there's no land cost involved in that. And we have very ambitious programs to do that. So that is a challenge that is going to remain in front of us, to find more and more innovative ways to buy, to build affordable housing that is something that is affordable for people who you know, who live and work in the city. And we want them to continue to live and work here, both because we need them to work here in our economy, but also because we don't want to be a city that consists entirely of people who are very well-to-do and those who are struggling. The homelessness part is even more complicated, and it's complicated by the prevalence of special challenges a lot of the people who are experiencing homelessness face, whether it is mental illness or whether it's a substance use issue. And so what we're having to do there is build more and more, and again, we're having quite a bit of success with the help of the both governments, building supportive housing, which is housing that gives people a home, but it also is a home with supports. There are mental health workers, people helping people find a job, people helping to get others housed permanently. And those are people, in many cases, not all, that are living in the encampments, for example. And, you know, we are just determined to make sure that what we do is provide a proper housing alternative for those people, because both because that's going to be better for them, but also because we can't have people living in parks. It's not healthy, it's not safe, and it's not legal.
The transition from this conversation seems natural to talk about policing now. And you mentioned mental illness. There has been so much more importance placed on mental illness in recent years, and the need for police officers to be trained in being able to take situations and de-escalate them if they're becoming violent because of somebody's mental illness. Help people understand in this city why we need to spend an additional 2.3% on the police budget going forward for 2022.
Well, I mean, first of all, 96% of the 2.3% increase, that's $25 million, is going to simply pay for the adjustments to compensation that are provided for in the collective agreement. So that those are already baked into a collective agreement that was signed several years ago. So most of the increase is going to that. But also within the same budget, though, thanks to, you know, prudent financial management, we're able to expand the neighborhood police officer program, which is a generally acknowledged successful program that has people doing the old-fashioned thing of walking a beat. They actually get to know the people, young and old, by first name. And it's not the police officers arriving in a car with the lights and sirens going. It's a police officer who's walking up and down the streets of your neighborhood all the time. We are, and we have, expanded the mobile crisis intervention team, which addresses people in distress, because we get 32,000 of those calls every year. And a lot of them are better handled by a team consisting of a police officer and a mental health professional, as opposed to two police officers. And that has now been expanded by the same budget. And I would point out one more thing, just when you mentioned de-escalation. We will also be initiating, and this is within the city's budget, a program this year, this winter, to have an entirely civilian-led and civilian-consisting response to a lot of these calls. So we'll kind of divide them and send out a new team. We're calling it a crisis response team that is not police, to help people who are in distress with mental illness. I am just telling you, I'm very determined not to succumb to those who would make these claims, which I find to be incredibly simplistic and misleading. Well, we can just cut 20% of the police budget and everything will be fine. I mean, if you look at what's happened in the U.S. where they've done that, it's been a disaster. And I'm just not going to compromise on the safety of the city and the safety of people living here. But at the same time, you know, three of the years I've been mayor, the police budget increase has been zero. But this was a year when, because of the collective agreements and because of some of these other things we wanted to do that are innovative, we're hiring 15 more people in the police to boost our efforts on missing people after that report that was written about the terrible situation that arose where some people lost their lives. So these are things that I'm quite happy to defend, and it's all part of that balance you strike between, yes, trying to have people, perhaps other than police, do things that might be better done by somebody else, but at the same time supporting the police and keeping the city safe.
Mayor Tory, what are you looking forward to most this year in 2022, perhaps being reelected?
Well, I'm not. I haven't made any decision about that. I really have been entirely consumed with the pandemic and the budget, the city's budget, which was released yesterday. It's a lot of hard work when we're in what I call COVID times because, you know, for example, the TTC's revenue has been half of what it normally is because the ridership is half. And so you have to try and find ways to make up for that. And that amounts in dollar terms to close to $1 billion of money we just don't have because people aren't riding the transit. So I'm just looking forward, forgetting about elections, I'm looking forward to getting through this year and getting on with a recovery because I really hope, and I'm not a scientist, but I hope that, you know, we will be able to start to see the pandemic recede and we can get back to the really important job of having the city recover because this has done some damage to, obviously, to smaller businesses and to, you know, neighborhoods where if you look at some of the main streets in the neighborhoods and you see some of the windows that are papered over on the stores, that, you know, that saps the strength of that neighborhood because the strength of that neighborhood is in part, you know, coming from the vitality of its main street. So we've got to get to work on that. And I'm already at work on it, but I've really got to focus on it when the pandemic starts to recede and we get the budget sort of passed and behind us for this year.
So if you're not going to give the morning Zoom the scoop as to whether you're going to run for a third term, can you tell us by when you will make that decision?
You have to make it soon, just because, you know, in your own case, you have to sort of, you know, have a plan that you want to present to the people to get a mandate on, and you have to put together a team, obviously, because the election comes in the fall. And if you're not going to run, you want to do that out of fairness to the people who might, you know, give them some time to do the same things I just mentioned. You know, and it has to start with your family, because in the end, as most people in public life will tell you, it's a family decision, because, you know, the way I work, I mean, that you call yourselves the Sisters of Sunrise, well, I can tell you, I am in my office before the sunrise so that I could join you in the kind of hours you keep, and that, you know, it has an impact on your life. And so, and I'm not complaining, I'm just noting that as something that you have to sort of start with, and you have to start with, you know, do you want to be doing this job? Because if these are not jobs you hold for the sake of holding them, you hold them because you really believe you can make a positive difference. And if you think you might have, you know, might have run out of the way to do that, or that you are, you know, are fatigued in any way, then, you know, you have an obligation, I think, and I'm at a stage in my life in many different respects where I don't have to do the job, so you have to want to do it.
Right. You need to confer with the boss at home, don't you?
Yeah,
that's what you're saying.
No question about that. Yeah, you got it.
Go Barb.
Yeah, that's right.
It's funny you say that because when I was a talk show host, I normally did sort of business and politics, but once in a blue moon, you'd do a segment based on some story that was out about who makes all the decisions in households, and I would come on and tell the truth, which is, you know, that it's the women who run the households and make most of the decisions and so on, because they're just more organized and focused than men, generally. And there'd always be some guy who'd phone in and say, oh, no, no, you've got it all. John, you're selling men out. You know, I wear the pants in our house. I make all the decisions. And I would inevitably say to that man who would call, well, could you just get your wife and bring her to the phone? And we would talk to her a bit about that. And she was never home. Like, you know, she's asleep or she's out or she's busy. And so, but it just reminds me when you talk about the boss, because I know who the boss is, and that's why I have to take the time to talk to her about that.
Absolutely. Toronto Mayor John Tory, is it too late, because we're well into January now, to wish a happy new year?
It's never too late.
Okay.
You know, I mean, like, because I hope we do have a happy new year.
Yeah.
And it's still new probably till you're past the 6 month mark. And, you know, I do believe, like, I have great hope about Toronto, leaving politics out of it. This city, all the strengths that had it booming, you know, before the pandemic came, are still there. Smart people, a real commitment to diversity and to inclusion, you know, a great sort of industrial strength that we have here in many different industries. So I just think that when we can get the pandemic behind us, the immigration that's going to come, which has been good for us all the way along. So I want it to be a happy 22, and the best thing to do would be to get vaccinated so we can get the pandemic behind us and then get on with what I know will be a solid recovery. And, you know, great arts and culture too, by the way, and look at how they're struggling. The artists, you know, can't perform and can't show their work and so on just because of all this shutdown. So we got to get that brought to an end ASAP.
Toronto Mayor John Tory, thank you.
Good to talk to you both. Good luck.